Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Mia Lorick from Locke Lord in Houston. Welcome to the podcast, Mia.
Thanks for having me.
We're very happy to have you. And why don't we start off by having you tell our listeners a little about yourself, your background, where you're from, the basics to get us started.
Of course. I'm a litigation and appellate partner at Locke Lord in Houston, Texas. My practice is probably 50% trial work, 50% appellate work. I did not major in political science or your typical undergraduate degree to get to law school. I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Modern Dance and Musical Theater. So my background is a little bit different than most lawyers, but I like to think that it adds to some of my theater and excitement in the courtroom and at oral argument. So I'm really excited to be here to talk about my experience, my background, and what I hope to accomplish in the future.
That's awesome. Well, we hope you add some vibrancy because Todd and I aren't the most exciting guys talking about appellate law here all day. So we're glad to have someone that's got a little more personality.
We're going to talk about sort of your non-traditional path to appellate practice. And that was one of the reasons why we asked you to come on the show. But I had no idea before we started this conversation that your non-traditional path goes all the way back to your undergrad major. And so that is really interesting. And yeah, you're likely to add an injection of personality that we don't have. So we're super pleased to hear about that. So after college, did you go straight into law school or did you have some time in between?
I had time in between as a starving artist in New York. So my undergraduate degree is with North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Majored in modern dance, musical theater, and then I moved back to New York. I grew up part of my childhood in New York. So after college, I went back. And for about 3.5-4 years, I performed with different dance companies and musical theater shows, and then decided to go to law school.
Have you ever been drafted by the Houston Bar to do any of their sort of sideshow musical? We do a lot of that here in Austin. I know other bar associations do too, but you would just seem like a natural fit for some kind of performance art that lawyers don't ordinarily participate in.
I was being heavily recruited prior to COVID. I'll just say that.
So what made you decide to go back to law school? That's quite a transition from the arts world in New York.
Yeah, my mom is really the one that kind of always said she thought that I had a great personality to become a lawyer. She said I was very outgoing. I liked to talk and kind of debate and, like most parents see in their children, argue. So she was the one that recommended law school. But it really started when I was 12. My dad died tragically in an accident in Miami, Florida, and it sparked a lawsuit that lasted about a decade. And so the lawyer that we worked with in Florida kind of became a part of our family for that decade. I learned a lot about the legal system, practicing law, going into court, discovery, depositions. And so that was kind of always in the background. Even as a dancer, I just kind of started thinking about things from a different angle, being a performer and wondering, you know, who's advocating on behalf of these artists? Who's kind of reviewing contracts for these artists? What does it mean when you join a union? Kind of different things like that. And as I became, you know, more experienced in the dance and arts world, going to auditions and joining different companies, the desire to kind of learn more about the law really grew and grew. And I had a conversation with my mom and she said, look, I think this would be the perfect time in your career to go to law school.
You went to my favorite law school, the University of Houston, where I went to. How did you end up in Houston from New York?
So after my dad passed, my mom, who is from Port Arthur, Texas, decided to move the family back to Texas. My dad, Zachary Bro, was a jazz musician. So that was how we moved from Texas originally to New York. He played in jazz nightclubs. He was nominated for a Soul Train Music Award. So we lived in New York there. And then after he passed, we moved to Texas. But my mom, for probably obvious reasons, didn't want to go back to Port Arthur, but wanted to be somewhere close where she could still visit family. So we ended up in Houston.
I grew up in the Golden Triangle, so I understand that very well.
You've got an incredible legacy, I would say, of art tendencies in your family, and it just seems like it's just carried forward to you. I just have to ask now before I forget, you explained your interest in the law from your unique personal perspective, but has that carried forward into your law practice today? Are you working with musicians, dancers, other kinds of artists in your practice at all?
Not yet. But it's funny that you touch on that, because that is something that I'm very interested in doing. And having been a person that has stayed involved in the arts, obviously, I still have friends that are in the arts that perform on Broadway, that are in various shows. It is a practice area that I'm very interested in.
So U of H, after you graduated, what did you wind up doing right after law school?
I worked at a firm, a regional firm here in Texas, and I targeted that firm, Roberts Markell, because I saw a lot of their young lawyers getting courtroom experience. So I was the person, I arrived at U of H orientation, you know, so I'm like pre-1L, and I'm like, where are the mock trial tryouts? Where are the moot court tryouts? I want to be in the courtroom. Like, let's just get this ball rolling. So I did both of those things while in law school, and it was really important for me to end up at a law firm that I could use that experience and get just really good hands-on experience early on. So Roberts Markell had some lawyers from U of H there, and I saw kind of what they were doing, trying cases, taking depositions, handling dispositive motion hearings, and I said, I want to go there.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
Another aspect of your non-traditional path to being a board-certified civil appellate lawyer is you went straight from law school into a firm rather than taking the judicial clerkship route. Did you know? It sounds like you really wanted to be in the courtroom, but did you have an idea going into private practice as a young lawyer that you wanted to do appellate work?
I did not. I think I started with my first firm, and then maybe about 6 months in, I was handling a motion for summary judgment. I was able to argue that motion, and then the motion went up on appeal in an interlocutory appeal. And that was kind of my first introduction to, well, wait a minute, I don't necessarily want to hand this off. Like, this presents some interesting issues. Appeals, having been on the moot court team, I kind of was exposed to that in law school, but not in the real world. And it just seemed fascinating to me that you could handle a case that then would make law that is published. I mean, I just thought that that was incredible. And I was like, I can't be cut out of that process.
That's a very traditional lawyer attitude, I would say. We all hear the trial lawyer speak of, well, I know the case the best. I handled it in the trial court. Nobody knows it better than I do. I should be the one to handle the appeal. And of course, many of us in our particular practice area kind of roll our eyes at that and think, yeah, but how well do you know the appellate court, the judge's appellate practice? How well do you write? Can you make an appellate oral argument as opposed to a jury argument? But it sounds like to me that you're definitely got a different approach to it, because you're really focusing on the legal aspect of it rather than necessarily the factual stuff. And gosh, with your background and training, I just find that fascinating, because I go in to argue a case and I'm just like, I hope I don't bore the panel to death. Performance art is not something that I could be described as doing, but I suppose there are boundaries to that too. I mean, I guess you learned along the way that what an appellate argument was and what the confines of it were. And Do you have to hold yourself back a little bit when you're standing at the lectern? Oh, goodness.
Yeah, but you're exactly right. I mean, the feedback that I got in saying, I don't want to be boxed out of this appeal, I handled this motion, the feedback was exactly that. It was, well, you handled the motion. Somebody with fresh eyes needs to look at it to handle the appeal. And I won't call myself pushy or aggressive. I'll say assertive, and I speak up for things that I want. I just said, well, can I do the research? And can I write one section of the brief? If I write one section of the brief or I do research and you're not happy with it, then that's one thing. But if I do the research and I write a section of the brief and you're okay with it, then can you put me on another appeal? Not necessarily an appeal where I was the trial lawyer, but just give me that opportunity. So that was kind of how I got the door cracked open just a smidge.
That's an important lesson, and one that I feel like gets under-discussed in appellate practices. There are a lot of people who didn't necessarily go the federal clerkship route or the state clerkship route that want to do it. And, you know, sometimes it's just asking is the way to get in, let them know that you're interested, even though you're doing something else, and give it a shot.
Yeah, that's right. I think young lawyers, you're a great example to young lawyers about how to break in, even those who have taken the traditional path, because it's a hard practice area in a firm of any size to break into, period. We've talked about that a lot on the show, but I admire your, I'll call it tenacity, your desire to do it and get the experience of it. We say pretty often here that having trial experience is a good thing for an appellate lawyer to do, but I think we agree we could look at it from the flip side too. Having some appellate experience is good for a trial lawyer as well. But you've managed, I think, in your practice with it being in roughly 50-50, that's pretty unique. We don't see that a lot. And so that's really pretty cool the way that you've developed that. So you were at your previous firm, but you made the change to Locke Lord here fairly recently, I understand.
Yeah, I moved in January of 2021. And the reason for the move was after becoming board certified in civil appellate law and handling some trials at my prior firm, I really had a desire to start working on even larger cases. So multi-party, more amounts in controversy, more federal cases. And I knew some of the people at Locke Lord. It's a great, great law firm. Another appellate partner, Chris Dove, is well known in the appellate community. And so it really, really seemed like the perfect fit. And it has turned out to be the perfect fit. I'm already getting involved in a lot of the trial work here as trial counsel and as appellate counsel, and then some of the appeals that they have going on at the firm. And so it's been really incredible.
That's great. Any particular types of cases that you focus on or that you focused on at your old firm?
Yeah, so I'm still doing a lot of real estate litigation, and then Locke Lord handles a lot of energy litigation. And so I've been getting involved with that, which has seen quite the uptick after the winter storm here in Texas. So that's been fun. It's been very fast paced, and I love it. I thrive in that kind of environment. So I joined at the perfect time.
I would say they're lucky to have you, and you bring that unique perspective in as a, I mean, coming in as a partner too. That's a nice platform to be able to develop your practice further in. I did notice from looking at your biographical information that I guess it was at Roberts Markell, you were really heavily involved in the diversity initiatives that that firm had put on. And you also, I see, actually sit on diversity and inclusion panels pretty frequently. Tell us about your experience in doing that.
Yeah. So my last firm, I actually started their diversity and inclusion initiative. I joined the firm, and in looking at the website, I saw that it was very diverse, but they didn't really have a statement or any kind of commitment to diversity, at least publicly. So one of the things that I'm pretty big on is rather than complain about it or be mad about it, what can you do to change it? So I went in and I drafted a proposal, said we needed a committee. Here are some of the initiatives I'd like to start. And it was accepted by the executive committee probably within 30 minutes of me sending the proposal. I chaired that committee. We accomplished a lot of initiatives based on retention, recruiting, just internal policies. And then that kind of made me realize that I was really passionate about this area of the law. I was passionate about making sure that law firms kind of change with the times. I mean, law schools are more diverse than ever at this point, not just gender diversity, but racial diversity, diversity in backgrounds. I mentioned earlier, I didn't have an undergraduate degree in political science. It's in modern dance and musical theater. All of that, to me, adds to diversity. The more diversity you have at the table, the better you're able to represent the community. Our community in Houston, Austin, Dallas is very diverse. And in order to provide good representation to those clients, you have to have a legal team that represents that community. So I started speaking on panels for diversity and inclusion, attending conferences, and just kind of talking to people about what do we want the legal profession to look like in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and how do we get there? What are some internal things that we can do when it comes to hiring and retention? You know, looking at how you're hiring. Are you hiring friends and family? Are you hiring at all of the law schools that you could be recruiting from? So I've spoken for the ABA on that topic, the HBA, and a few other organizations.
Well, I think the state bar, you know, Texas Bar CLE, that's a pretty frequent topic for the statewide conferences. It seems like you would be a great candidate, if you haven't done that already, to participate in those panels. And so we're happy to plug you for that to the extent anybody's listening. I think before we started recording, we were talking about, we've tried to lift up folks whose, you know, voices aren't always heard as loudly as others. And that's important work that you've done. And yeah, to the extent, you know, we can pass along, hey, if you need a diversity and inclusion panelist, you know, contact Mia Lorick at Locke Lord in Houston.
Absolutely. It's a conversation that unfortunately needs to continue to occur. You know, to your point, I think it's one that has been happening more and more, but it still hasn't made its way to all corners of the practice. And in particular, appellate practice is one that really needs diversity and inclusion. And I think there's a lot of great people out there who are recognizing that. It's just taking the steps and figuring out the steps to make that process better. And particularly making the pipeline start in law schools and, you know, clerkships and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm glad to hear that you're out there helping promote those things.
So I suspect you got to Locke Lord in January of 21. I bet they already had a program in place when you got there.
They have an excellent program here at Locke Lord, and it's one of the other things that attracted me to the firm.
Have you been able to participate in the program at Locke Lord so far, or what are your plans there?
I have. They were extremely welcoming and wanted to talk to me as soon as I got here about some of my ideas. So we've met a few times about that. I've already been pulled in to assist with law school recruiting to kind of help in that regard. I did some recruiting at my last firm, and so I had some ideas and thoughts about that. And so they've been just so like open arms with me, you know, come and share your ideas and tell us how we can be better.
I was going to ask, what are some resources or places that people could go that are in firms or on their own that may not have access to a formal program or would like to start a program and increase those efforts? Are there places they can go to find those?
Well, Todd mentioned the State Bar of Texas. So the State Bar has excellent resources and articles just on the website that you can download for free. The Houston Lawyer magazine has had some exceptional articles lately on the topics of diversity and inclusion. And then honestly, given the climate that we are in, everything that happened with George Floyd last year, if you simply Google diversity and inclusion kind of resources, books, so many books and articles come up. There's YouTube kind of channels that are guided towards this topic. And I think there's just so much material out there that actually what I've heard is not that it's a lack of finding the material, it's being overwhelmed and not really knowing where to start. What I would say, especially to a non-diverse lawyer who is wanting to kind of be an ally and help in this diversity and inclusion space, is just to start somewhere. There's no right or wrong way to do that. It's just having the commitment and saying that you want to learn and you want to make things better, whether it's in your law firm or in your community, is just the right attitude. There's no right or wrong way to do it as long as you're doing something.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. Seems like a part of diversity initiatives would be the concept of mentorship. You probably get the opportunity, maybe not at LawCorps yet, but you probably get the opportunity, Will, before too much longer, to mentor younger lawyers coming in to the firm, or maybe summer associates now that summer is almost upon us. And then I'm sure even outside of your own firm, there's abundant opportunities to do that. I know you've been directly involved in that. What kind of work have you been doing with respect to mentorship?
So I have quite a few mentees. It's something that I am very passionate about. I think that especially if you've had a challenging upbringing or kind of getting to where you are, that you have an obligation to kind of reach back down the ladder and help other people up, whether it's accepting an invitation for coffee, lunch, a phone call, just kind of offering some advice about your story and what you went through. So I mentor quite a few law students and younger lawyers. I think that that kind of began in my role as an adjunct professor at U of H, teaching trial advocacy, depositions, and then also being involved in the NIDA deposition course. I just met a lot of younger lawyers and law students and kind of threw it out there, you know, hey, I'm always here to help if you need anything. And a lot of them have followed up and reached out on via email or on LinkedIn. And I make it a point to respond and offer the time that I can offer to help them out. And then it became apparent to me that the more people that I started talking to kind of had similar questions. So especially the women, what do I wear going into the office? What should I do about approaching a partner for work? Those kinds of questions. And so what I did was I started a blog called Sharply Suited that just took all of the little nuggets, that pieces of advice that I was giving my mentees, but also pieces of advice that I was receiving from my mentors. And I put it into one spot and kind of said, this would be a great way to kind of get this information out. And then I took it a step further and I said, well, I think mentorship is more than just saying, hey, here are the things you need to do, steps 1 through 10. But what am I doing that would actually impact a lot of the law students and their concerns that I'm hearing? And so that's how I started the Suited for Success scholarship. I remembered that when I was in law school and I was competing for the mock trial team, it was, hey, you have to go out and make sure that you have a business suit for competitions. And I'm like, all right, no problem. I go out, I look at the price tag and I'm like, whoa, $500 for a suit jacket. Who can afford that? And so I kind of scraped my money together and I had one suit. And I remember, you know, if you've competed before for these advocacy competitions, you'll have multiple rounds back to back. Okay. You may have like 3 preliminary rounds. And then if you're lucky enough to break, you have 3 more rounds and you're doing all of that. So having one suit can be a bit challenging and it can be a bit of an ego kill and confidence kill if you're kind of self-conscious about that, you know, in the bathroom, kind of scrubbing your suit and hoping it dries by the morning. So that was something I dealt with. And I remember talking to a lot of my mentees and they were like, where can I find affordable clothing? Or is it okay to mix a suit jacket with a different pair of pants and skirts? And what if the blacks don't match? And so I started the scholarship as a way to kind of help with that. So the Suited for Success scholarship is awarded to law students and it's funds that they can use to buy a business suit or business clothing. So shirts that go underneath the suit, ties, shoes, anything that they would need that would help them for interviewing, job placement, or advocacy competitions. The first year that I did it, I self-funded the scholarship and gave out 2 scholarships at the University of Houston Law Center. And then I had a lot of friends kind of see it on LinkedIn. One of my friends here at LawCorps, Jonathan Palayo, is a graduate of the University of Texas, and he saw it and said, this would be so awesome to start at UT Law. And so my hope is to expand it throughout Texas to get more lawyers on board. A lot of lawyers have been supportive and donated to the scholarship. And so this year at UT Law, we awarded 10 scholarships. And at U of H has not awarded yet, but I'm hoping it's 7 to 10 this year as well. So we've gone from 2 to 10 And my hope in the future is that it's even bigger so that we're getting a lot of law students and baby lawyers in fabulous looking suits.
If people wanted to either donate or support the scholarship or maybe expand it to different schools, how would be a good way to reach out to you to find out about that?
They could email me at mia.lorick@locklord.com. And I'd be happy to talk with them about expanding it either to their law school or talking to them about any amount that they're able to donate. There's no minimum amount. We accept all amounts, and the letters that these law students write that receive this scholarship, I think would just touch anybody's heart. And if you could only give $5, you'd be in 5 seconds, take everything I have, take this $5. The letters are just so heartwarming and so touching.
I remember very well those days when you think, okay, I've got one or two suits and I've got to figure out how to make this work. And it is just tough. It's very tough when you're, and that was 150 years ago because I'm old, but I can only imagine today knowing what law school costs, it's an even bigger financial pressure.
Oh, I think that's a fabulous program. And I'd love to see, I'll just call out my friends at St. Mary's, my law school, and say that we really could use that there. Texas Tech, you know, I'm sure they could use some business suits in West Texas to get ready for their advocacy. South Texas, good grief. They've got a great advocacy program. I'm sure they have some law students who could use that. It really is very impressive the way that that's taken off. And I certainly hope that it does expand to other law schools, because if Jody went to law school 150 years ago, it's at least 250 for me. And I recall the same dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Back in Todd's days, they still wore powdered wigs and knee breeches, but it's a little bit different. Morning coats.
At any rate, I wanted to come back to about the mentorship thing for just a minute was, you mentioned using LinkedIn and your blog as ways to mentor other lawyers. So I think one takeaway from that is that it doesn't have to be a formal mentorship program. Anybody through connections in real life on social media, you know, mentorship can take a lot of different forms. And so I think, you know, LinkedIn is really great if you can do it. Your blog is providing that information out there to the general public. I mean, you can reach a lot of people doing that, but I would encourage lawyers who want to get involved in mentorship. You don't have to do it as part of a formal program. You can do what you did and just make connections with people and talk with them and pick a younger lawyer. If you've got the time and energy to do some mentoring, just take an interest in them. And, you know, now that we're opening up a little bit, take them to lunch and talk about their lives and everything and just get to know them better. And I've tried to do that in my career. People did it with me, and it's incredible just the impact that really not a great amount of effort can have on someone who we all face, especially as young lawyers, imposter syndrome and trying to figure out our way in this practice of law. There's so much meaning that can come out of just those really modest efforts to mentor other people.
I agree. And I think once you become a lawyer, you kind of forget a little bit what it means to a law student to meet and connect with a lawyer or just to hear about your daily practice. I remember reaching out to a lawyer when I was a law student, and she said, I have 15 minutes kind of in between meetings. Would you want to come up to my office and maybe just meet for 15 minutes? And later she told me that she felt really bad. Like, oh my gosh, I only had 15 minutes and you had to like schlep all the way up to my office. And I told her, I said, oh my gosh, no, I had never been in a law office. Like 15 minutes was enough time for me to ask you questions that I wanted to ask. And just being in her law office, like seeing other lawyers walk around, it was incredible. And she didn't realize the impact that had on me. And so lawyers just have to remember that it doesn't take a lot of time. Maybe you're driving from a hearing back to the office and you have 10 minutes and you can talk to somebody during that commute, or you can meet for coffee. And if you have time for lunch, great, but it doesn't take a lot of effort. Like, we all have the time to mentor.
That's absolutely right. And we do kind of take things for granted sometimes. You're right. You know, thinking about, well, just coming to a law office and seeing it and being in the space can have a huge impact for somebody, even though it's something that before COVID I did every day and even now still do multiple days a week. That's a good thing to remember.
Well, one other thing I wanted to be sure and ask you about was how you balance having an active litigation practice, going to trial and dealing with all the things that go with that, with also having an active appellate practice? Because for me, you know, I steered my practice to really focus on appeals pretty early on. And looking back on it now, having to think about deposition schedules and discovery deadlines and talking to experts and designations and all that stuff, with all the sort of deep work kind of things that you have to do as an appellate lawyer, I had a real hard time reconciling that. And I don't think I would be able to do it well. So I'm always impressed by people who can. And so tell us how you balance those two, what I see as sort of competing areas for your time.
Sure. You kind of hit the nail on the head there. The trial work is very deadline oriented. Things come up very quickly. There could be a TRO that you hear about and you have to handle it that afternoon, or depositions, discovery, and always, you know, your fights with opposing counsel that are just riveting. But I think what I love about the appellate work is, and I think a lot of appellate practitioners like, that it's not so deadline focused. Sure, we have deadlines, but you usually have a lot of time before you're up on that deadline. There's rarely anything, unless there's some emergency relief in the appellate courts, there's rarely anything that's going to come up that's going to kind of derail your day. So scheduling wise, just making sure that if there is an appellate deadline, I'm not kind of waiting until the week before to write the brief. I mean, you want to make sure that the brief is the best work of art that you've submitted to whatever court of appeals. And so starting that research early and working on the brief early and circulating it to your colleagues for edits early. So that way, if anything does come up in your trial practice, you're not like, oh my gosh, I have a brief to write. Also communicating with your colleagues saying, hey, you know, we're trying to schedule these depositions and I know that you really want to do these, you know, the second week in June, but I have a brief that's due at the end of June. So can we push that up a week? And just being proactive about letting everybody know what you have going on. I'm also a little bit, I guess, nerdy in the sense that I will kind of have folders of different hot button, what I call hot button appellate issues, things that keep recurring. So for instance, like the TCPA anti-SLAPP statute that comes up a lot, attorney's fees, and just kind of stay abreast of the cases that are coming down and things that are happening in the appellate realm so that when you are writing a brief, you're not kind of starting from scratch with your research. You have that not only base knowledge, but then, hey, I remember the case that came down a few months ago and I've already read it and kind of analyzed it. And so you're starting from that perspective. But I love it. I mean, I think that having the appellate experience and applying it to your trial practice is invaluable. You have to know how to craft an order that is going to be scrutinized on appeal. You have to know how to preserve error in the trial court, talking to your colleagues in the trial court, not in a way of like, you don't know what you're doing, but just, hey, here are some things to consider. Here's a case that kind of discusses these issues that you're having at the trial level. And I just think it makes you a well-rounded person. I don't know that I would want my practice to be 100% trial work. It is very stressful. I like having the, not lull, but having that time where you can really sit and dive into a narrow issue of law and research it and really find all the nuances and cases about it. I mean, I think that that is kind of what I think of as more like relaxing. I love the balance of the two.
Any advice for students who maybe didn't come up the traditional path that want to break into appellate law?
Yeah, I think kind of what I was mentioning earlier is speaking up, asking to be a part of the appellate process. Maybe you're not going to get hired in the appellate section or you're not going to be considered an appellate lawyer. But I think that you need to make sure that you're kind of taking the steps that you need to take that would make you a good appellate lawyer. If you work for a law firm that has an appellate section and you're not in the section, or they're not asking you to write a brief, but you're an excellent writer, you have great points, you know how to research and kind of apply that research to the analysis that needs to happen, why would they not utilize you, especially if you're showing an interest? So making sure that your writing is really great, getting feedback on your writing. You can't write something and then think, well, my gosh, this is the best motion to ever be filed in the court system ever. I mean, yeah, it could be great, but ask a partner or a more experienced lawyer for feedback. When you handle a hearing or a deposition, ask for feedback, read your transcript, look at how you sound on paper. I mean, try to get the experience to just continue getting better and better and better. And then not really taking no for an answer. So asking if you can do research on an appeal, asking to write a section of the brief. The first oral argument that I did, I didn't get that oral argument because they said, oh my gosh, Mia, the second year, she needs to handle this. No, that's not how I got it. I got it because I said, well, the lawyer who is going to handle this oral argument is going to need to do a moot argument. She's going to need to spar against somebody. Why not offer to be that person? So I offered to do that. I think we did 3 moot rounds at the law firm with other lawyers watching. And then by the end of it, I said, hey, you know, there's this waiver issue. It's probably like a 3 to 5 minute issue at the oral argument. Can I argue that 3 to 5 minutes? She said, sure, take 5. The next time I argued, I got half of the argument. So it's not taking an all or nothing approach and saying, well, I'm not in the section. I didn't get to write the full brief or argue in front of the Texas Supreme Court. So I'm leaving. I'm going somewhere else. It's taking the baby steps and maybe starting with the research, the memo, a section of the brief, saying that you'll meet an attorney on a Saturday to just go through their oral argument outline and offer feedback. Little things like that, that show your interest in the practice, show your commitment to doing the work, and that you just really have a desire to do it. And I think that that is what people want. They want zealous advocates for their clients. And if I have a lawyer, a young lawyer, who is like, I'm super interested in this issue, look at these cases, here are my ideas, here's a great outline for the brief, I'm going to take that any day over somebody who I think is smart and I have to kind of go to them and say, hey, here's what I need. So just remembering that a passion will take you a long way. Passion, hard work, and the ability to ensure that you're getting that constructive feedback to become better.
Great advice.
Gosh, yeah, that's a very, I think, comprehensive list, almost like a checklist for a young lawyer who wants to get into appellate practice, but maybe doesn't know the way and wasn't informed, you know, of or didn't take that traditional path that might put them into the appellate section coming right out of law school. But as we've said, going into the appellate section isn't necessarily the path that even those who are on the traditional path take. Sometimes, whether you had a clerkship or not, whether you're editor of the law review or not, those are the kinds of things that you have to do if you decide that you're going to become an appellate lawyer to actually get there and make it. And so that is really great advice. And I look forward to sharing that with other people who want to get on this path. That's just wonderful. Well, we've come to the point in the program, Mia, where we ask our guests for a tip or a war story. And that checklist you just rattled off is a really good tip, but I'm excited to hear from your perspective what specific tip or war story that you would like to share with our listeners.
I would give the tip of being nice and respectful to everyone that you encounter. There's something to be said about being a great lawyer and working hard and kind of rising to the peak of your career. But if you're not a nice person and people don't like you, you're not going to be successful. And that goes for dealing with colleagues at work, dealing with law students, dealing with your paralegal or assistant, dealing with the clerk at the court, the parking attendant at the courthouse. I mean, everybody. It's such a small community and reputation carries you very far. You'd be surprised how many calls I get just from people who say, another person was speaking very highly of you, so I wanted to reach out, or that sort of thing. So yeah, your hard work matters, but I think maintaining a good attitude that's respectful of everyone around you and inclusive of everyone around you will take you so much further.
A great tip. What a perfect thing to end on, because that's absolutely right.
Agree 100%. Mia, thank you so much for coming on with us. We've enjoyed visiting with you and hearing about your journey from a very non-traditional major coming into law school and your path since then. And I think it's hopefully people who listen who aren't quite sure of their own path will take some encouragement from what you've done. And you've certainly been successful with it. So congratulations. And we're glad to get to know you and count you among our guests on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure being here. And I meant what I said earlier about people reaching out. So if there are any listeners that want to reach out, mia.lorick@locklord.com, I'd be happy to visit.
We'll drop that into the show notes for today's episode. So thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.